this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise, and I'm back with episode 4. Thank you so much if you're listening again, and welcome if you're a new listener. This episode is all about coastal hauntings. I'll be talking about the very haunted Stave Falls Powerhouse, Dead Man's Island, the famous waterfront station, and the ghost ship, the SS Valencia. This week, there will also be a bonus place that I'm going to be putting up on the blog that's not necessarily haunted, but it did play host to a very famous killer clown, which I think is really awesome. It's a cool little gem, so I'll be including the Bunsen Lake Powerhouse too. I will, of course, include links and photos in my episode 4 blog, so make sure to check that out on my website at realscarypodcast.ca under the heading Episodes. I do want to take a quick minute to thank Susie with BC Hydro for confirming with me the stories that are on the Stave Falls website. I hope you enjoy this episode. Let's dive right in. So the first place I'm going to be talking about is the powerhouse at Stave Falls, located in Mission, BC. Construction on the powerhouse began in 1911. This facility supplied power for almost 90 years. Eventually, however, as the population grew, this powerhouse became insufficient. The original powerhouse still stands and is now a National Historic Site of Canada. This building serves to educate visitors on the birth of hydraulic power, and they actually provide guided tours of this original facility. Not only can you see the history up close and personal, participate in interactive displays and other activities, you can also hear all about why the Stave Powerhouse has gained recognition of another kind, for being haunted. There are many reports of whispers, toilets flushing, chairs being dragged, and of elevators opening on their own. These experiences have even extended to seeing shadowy figures banging pipes and the strong smell of tobacco smoke. A tour guide who was working back in 2003 heard about the hauntings but was skeptical. On her first tour, however, she was walking backwards along the powerhouse and bumped into a person. She turned around to apologize to find that there was no one there. Another guide told a story about turning on a light in a part of the building and spotting in a window the reflection of a dark-haired man standing behind her. And again, there was no such man in sight. Many visitors and guides report that they have heard a dog barking in the atrium. The legend with this sighting is that two men and their dog were on a boat on Stave Lake when the dog capsized the boat. The men both drowned in the accident and the dog survived. People wonder if the dog has come back to search for its owners. Another story comes from an employee opening the visitor center. She unlocked the doors, turned off the alarm, and went inside. As she was walking in, she heard a man's voice yell out, "Hello?" She knew she was the only person in the building. Was it the dark-haired man of the earlier sightings? Guides also talk of hearing families laughing and enjoying the exhibits at the end of the night, when there are no visitors left in the building. They've even said that some of the exhibits begin to work on their own. There is something in the paranormal community referred to as residual energy or imprint hauntings, and I wonder if this is the case here. It could be the case at some of the other places we've talked about as well, and I'm sure some that we'll talk about in the future. A residual haunting is described as the playback of a past event. So for example, hearing the dog barking, this could be residual energy. That was a traumatic event that happened, and it could just be a replay of the moments when the dog was searching for its owners. So this is a theory I would like you to keep in mind, as I will most likely reference residual energy or imprint in the future. I will link more about this on the blog for you to read if you would like. In the visitor center, there's an area called the History Hall. This is a particularly haunted area. One tour guide has heard her name called on multiple occasions. Visitors report feeling ice cold when they walk through certain spots. One day, a guide was in the middle of his tour and was interrupted by a slamming door and footsteps. As he investigated, he kept hearing sounds as though someone was just walking around the corner in front of him. He went back to his office and the phone rang. He picked it up and no one was on the other end. Lights are also a common source of activity at the powerhouse. They frequently don't work or need to be fixed, even within a day of having been fixed already. Some employees have a theory. There was a man who helped with the facility's construction who came from the local gas company. He thought that electricity was a waste of time and money. He believed gas lights were the better option. So could he be the one still inserting his opinion, messing with the lights? Maybe. The last story is pretty cool. There have been some sightings from outside the powerhouse where people report seeing someone walking along the top floor past the top windows. But the twist is there is no floor up there. They're just windows. So one day when some employees were in a small room in the visitor center doing some inventory, one of the employees looked up at the ceiling to find a trail of footsteps across the roof. How did they get there? So if you'd like to see this place for yourself, you're in luck. As I said, you can tour this place. They're very open about paranormal incidents, and I will link all of the information in the blog. Next, we'll be exploring the mysterious Dead Man's Island in Vancouver. This tiny little unassuming island is just south of Stanley Park, and really it's a stone's throw away. It's very close. Most people might not even notice that it's there. This island is truthfully called Dead Man's Island. It's not just a nickname, and it currently houses a Canadian naval base. Many people believe this island to be cursed by the blood that was shed on its ground way back in the 1800s. At that time, the island was just simply called Island by the native people that first inhabited the area. Two area tribes, the Northern and Southern Salish Nations, were in the midst of a bloody war. The Southern tribe kidnapped 200 women and children and demanded that their enemy hand over 200 warriors in exchange for their freedom. When the Northern tribe complied, the 200 men were ruthlessly slaughtered right there with a barrage of arrows and knives. Now, according to legend, the following day, flaming flowers grew where the dead had fallen, and the Southern tribe abandoned the land, deeming it a cursed place plagued with black magic. It was from this point on the island was known as Dead Man's Island. The island was seen as a place only fit for burial ground, and that is exactly what it became. The Squamish people began to bring their dead there, placing the bodies in cedar coffins and wedging them in the branches of ancient trees. This type of burial was pretty commonplace back then. Years later, when the white settlers began to arrive in the area, a man named John Morton went to the island. He was curious as to what these boxes were, and as legend has it, he prodded one and it disintegrated and showered him with human remains. I have no doubt that it was at this point old Johnny came to realize why it was called Dead Man's Island. The settlers would later remove the bodies and bury them in their own tradition below ground. Though the bodies were removed, this island remained a place only fit for the dead. In the early 1870s, the island became a dumping ground for corpses of those who couldn't afford a more upscale burial. Merchants, servants, prostitutes, and lepers were among some of the people buried there. When the bodies were buried on the island, the burials were less than respectful. They were usually dumped into shallow graves in whatever spaces could be found between the trees. And if they were marked, it was with a simple wooden cross or a picket. The graves would become overgrown and the names on the markers washed away quickly. It would soon become impossible to tell where there were graves. From 1888 to 1892, smallpox was an epidemic and the island became a quarantine zone. No one who was sent to the island was expected to be seen again, and most were not. The majority of the casualties from smallpox were left to be buried on the island. Moving into the 1900s, the island was leased to an industrialist named Theodore Ludgate. His goal was to open a logging operation on the island. Locals were not happy about this. They thought the island should not be developed. And local authority had also warned him that he was not to use the land for logging. He went to the island anyway and was met by a police force. These disputes lasted until 1911 when Ludgate was finally granted permission to log on the island, and he wasted no time, stripping it of most of its trees. In 1909, during one of the famous showdowns between Ludgate's loggers and the police, officers were camped out on the island to ensure that no one would begin to chop down trees. It was during this campout that officers claimed to hear disembodied voices and screaming. They also heard chains rattling, and some even claimed to have seen ghostly skeletons that warned them of great harm to befall anyone who tried to chop down the trees on the island. The police chief did not take any of these claims seriously. He told his men just carry torches at night. In 1949, the government turned the land over to the Canadian Royal Navy, and it became home to the HMCS Discovery Naval Base. Since its construction, there have been all kinds of strange reports. Sounds of breaking glass, furniture being moved, disembodied voices, shouting, screaming, chanting, sounds of footsteps. There are even reports of being pushed and tapped by phantom hands, apparitions and glowing eyes in the fog. Ugh, that one's so creepy. Mysterious lights, shadow figures, and eerie, glowing, flame-like lights that emanate from the trees and form a human shape. People also report that objects go missing and end up in very strange places, and problems with the lights and electrical equipment. Supposedly, most of the incidents happen around building number one, and another location was once a holding cell for prisoners. There's a story that during the war, a young worker on the island was imprisoned for theft and ended up taking his own life in there. A famous story off the island comes from a leading seaman, Anne Marie Hamilton. I found these stories on mysteriousuniverse.org, and I will link this article in the blog. One night, she received special permission to stay on the island for the night so she could finish her assignment. It's not common for people to stay on the island for the night, so she wasn't expecting to be in company. The building she ended up staying in was building number one, and she was awoken by the sounds of two men going up an outside stairwell. She could hear them calmly chatting as they made their way to the third floor above her. She heard them moving furniture around and opening and closing doors. This lasted for about 30 minutes before all was finally silent again. She thought it was odd they were doing all of that at that hour, but she just assumed they'd also been granted permission to finish work that night. The next morning as she was leaving, she asked the gate's guardsman who had been at the base that night. He told her she was the only one on the island. No one else had come through the gates all night. She would later call the incident quite unnerving. No shit. I will also say that the only way on and off the island is past this guard through these gates. So really there would be no other way for someone to sneak in. In 1991, another story comes from a man named C. Gran. He was stationed at the base as security, as this was during the Gulf War, and they wanted to protect the base from possible anti-war vandals. One night, he heard the double doors in the main building opening and then slamming shut. He was immediately alarmed, as he should have been the only person there. He thought that maybe it was the base commissioner, so he radioed to ask where he was. He told Gran that he was at the front gate, where he'd been the entire time. Gran went to check. Perhaps an activist had broken in, but he couldn't find anyone, and the doors that he had heard open were tightly locked. Apparently, this sent him running from the building. The following year, in 1992, a seaman by the name of Jason Eldridge was in an office when he heard footsteps hurrying loudly down a stairwell nearby. He thought this was strange since he was supposedly the only person in the building. He looked out the window to check the stairwell and found that the lights were out. He called the front gate and the guard said no one else had arrived on the island. As he was on the call, he heard furniture begin to slide roughly across the floor above him. Eldridge went out to the stairwell, and the sound stopped. Naturally unsettled but determined to find out an explanation, he went to the third floor and found that it was dark. He turned the lights on to find there was nothing out of the ordinary. By this time, he was really creeped out, and he decided to call it a night. The last story is from 1994, when Petty Officer Rob Lowe was in the mess hall and heard the sounds of voices and heavy footsteps below him. There were reservists all over the base, so he didn't really think much of it, just assumed they were messing around down there. But eventually it got on his nerves, and he went downstairs to tell them to knock it off and keep it down. When he went down there, however, he found the entire area deserted. Confused, Lowe went back upstairs only to hear the ruckus start back up again. He rushed back down the stairs and was met yet again with an empty room. He still has no idea what happened that day. So with all of these stories, and they're pretty consistent ones too, I think it's safe to say this island truly has a very appropriate name. So as I said, this is now a military base. Therefore, there's no access to the public at all. It's heavily guarded. They do not do tours of any kind. Basically, the only glimpse would be from afar. Like I said, you can see it from Stanley Park, so maybe at night you can catch those eerie glowing lights moving around the island. The next place I'm going to be talking about is the Waterfront Station in Vancouver. This station was the western terminus for Canadian Pacific Railway until the late 1970s. Just days after it opened, soldiers flooded through the station and departed for Europe during the First World War. From its inception, the building has grown along with the growth of Vancouver itself. In 1977, the C-Bus began to operate, and in 1985, the Expo line of the SkyTrain began running. The final addition came in 2009 when the Canadian line opened. After more than 100 years of activity, it's not surprising that Waterfront Station has earned the title of one of the most haunted places in Vancouver. The waterfront's night security guards seem to be the most common witnesses to paranormal activity here. One night, a guard saw the apparition of a 1920s-era woman in a flapper-style dress. She was dancing alone in a corridor on the west side of the building. Waterfront Station was built in a time where traveling by train was something elegant and classy. So this side of the station held a dance hall and restaurants back in the day. As the guard began to approach her, he could hear the sound of 1920s jazz music playing. But as he got closer to her, the music stopped and she vanished. There have been other reports of people hearing 1920s-era music in the building late at night, and a few others have seen the dancing flapper as well. As I mentioned before with residual hauntings, it seems pretty plausible that that's what's going on here. The next common sighting is of three older women who appear to be sitting on a bench waiting for a train. They don't even appear to be aware or concerned with any living beings around them. And again, sounds like a residual situation. Now, this next story is really interesting. Another security guard received quite a scare one night while on patrol. He was in an old kitchen where food for the old CPR trains used to be prepared, and he found himself face to face with the apparition of an old woman. The woman stared at him intently with a mournful look on her face, and then began to advance toward him. He hightailed it out of there, but it wasn't the end of the story. He began dreaming of the old woman every night, and even saw her face in mirrors and windows. He had an urge to paint the face that was haunting him. He brought the finished portrait to the place that he first encountered her, and left it as an offering of sorts, and the hauntings for him stopped. Apparently, the painting is still there, rumor has it. Once when management tried to remove it, the person who had moved it began dreaming of the old woman. So he, very smartly, moved it back. Supposedly, initiation for new guards is to go down to the old kitchen and say hello to the old woman. The last and perhaps most famous ghost of the Waterfront Station is a man named Hub Clark. Legend has it that on the multiple railway tracks to the north of the building, the ghost of Hub Clark, who was a brakeman in the late 20s, can still be seen on rainy nights. Hub was killed while making some repairs in the rail yard. He slipped on wet tracks and was knocked unconscious. Tragically, a train came down the tracks and ran him over, decapitating him. Since then, on rainy nights, people claim to see a headless man carrying a lantern and wandering the tracks. Some have said that they've even seen him in different areas of Gastown. Now, Hub is actually linked to a ghost in the building next to the waterfront station. This building is called the Landing. This ghost is only seen by men and only on cold, wet nights. One night, a concierge saw her during his first shift alone. The woman was standing at one of the large windows at the back of the building, looking out at the water. He tried to approach her but found himself frozen in place. He realized that she was sobbing, and it got louder and more hysterical. And then, just like that, she was gone. And all that was left behind was a small puddle of water. Now, this part's really cool. The puddle is such a common occurrence that this part of the floor is actually warped. Crews have come in to try to find a source for the water, but have been unable to find any explanation. Now, here's the connection to the headless brakeman. People say that she is the widow of Hub Clark, looking out at the train tracks where he died. The last story is about the tragedy of the SS Valencia and how she became the only supposed ghost ship in the area, despite many shipwrecks on this coast. In 1882, William and Sons built a steamer that would be known as the SS Valencia. She was built as a passenger steamer for a route between California and Alaska. One day in 1906, the Valencia set off for Seattle from San Francisco. All was going well until early morning hours when the weather took a turn for the worst. The strong winds had pushed the steamer off course, and the crew had no idea just how far. Just before midnight on January 20th, in the thick fog, roaring cold winds, and pouring rain, the ship tore into a reef. The crew immediately backed the ship off the reef, but this only exposed the large gash in her bow where the cold water was now rushing into. The captain ordered her to run aground as he knew there was no saving her. In the panic and confusion that followed, 6 of the 7 lifeboats were lowered before the captain gave the actual order. 3 flipped over, spilling their passengers into the water. 2 capsized relatively quickly, sending the passengers into the water and to the same fate as the people in the first 3 boats. One boat made it away, and one of the survivors said the following. Screams of women and children mingled in an awful chorus with the shrieking of the wind, dash of the rain, and the roar of the beakers. As the passengers rushed on the deck, they were carried away in bunches by the huge waves that seemed as high as the ship's mastheads. The ship began to break up almost at once, and the women and children were lashed to the rigging above the reach of the sea. It was a pitiful sight to see frail women wearing only nightdresses with bare feet on the freezing ratlines, trying to shield children in their arms from the icy wind and rain. As you can imagine, the scene was chaotic and traumatizing. The few that were able to escape the sinking life rafts and the ship itself made it to shore. However, some were sucked back into the sea, and some fell from the slick rock as they tried to scale the cliffs out of the water. The rescue boats took longer than hoped to make it near the ailing ship due to the fog being so thick, the treacherous waters, and the confusion about how far they drifted. When the first survivors made it to shore and went for help, they gave the wrong location as they believed the ship had wrecked on the Washington shore and not where they actually were near Vancouver Island. On Wednesday morning, 2 tugboats arrived to see the Valencia, but shortly thereafter, the fog closed in and they lost their visual. The last lifeboat was ordered into the water and departed with roughly 10 men. Accounts from the survivors talk about the women refusing to get in the boat. Surely the sight of the other boats capsizing was a terrifying thought running through their minds. They chose to stay on the boat as they thought the waters looked more calm. They had also just seen the 2 rescue boats approaching in the fog. They believed that their rescue was coming shortly, and as the boat began to row away, the women were singing the hymn, "Nearer, My God, to Thee." Witnesses described the remaining passengers huddled together on the deck until a massive wave struck the ship, finally breaking it completely apart and sweeping the remaining passengers into the ocean. In the end, of the roughly 150 people aboard, roughly because the numbers do fluctuate slightly, only 37 men survived. All the women and children perished. Now, I mentioned in the first story the theory of residual energy. One article that I found on the Valencia explained it really well as it pertains to this story. So I quote, "There is a theory that persists in the paranormal world wherein moments of horror can tear at the fabric of time, causing a persistent residual loop that replays over and over again." I will have a link to this article in the blog. It's on a site called paranormalenlightenment.com, and I believe wholeheartedly this is the case with the Valencia. The paranormal accounts began almost immediately after the wreck. As one of the rescue ships, the SS City of Topeka, was headed back towards Seattle, they met an outward bound ship and they slowed to tell them of the news. The thick smoke from their stacks settled over the water in a heavy cloud. As the cloud broke, the people aboard the Topeka were horrified to see a ship in the distance, and that ship was the Valencia. 5 months after the tragedy, a fisherman claimed to have found a life raft from the ill-fated ship with 8 skeletons in it. This story has a few different versions and details, so I'm going to try my best to include them all. First version is that the boat and its dead were in a cave, but mysteriously there was a large boulder covering the entrance that would have made it impossible for the raft to get inside. The waters around the cave were too treacherous for them to remove the boat. Another version is that when the authorities came to remove the boat, it and its victims were gone. Another very common thing that's been reported by numerous people over time is that they've seen a lifeboat either floating with 8 skeletons in it, only to disappear when approached, or that the boat is actually being manned by the dead. The real lifeboat number 5 from the SS Valencia was found in 1933, floating in the Berkeley Sound. The boat was in surprisingly good condition, with much of its original paint still remaining. Seems very mysterious that a small boat drifting for nearly 30 years through all kinds of weather would be in that condition. There are actually numerous theories that involve a sort of Bermuda Triangle type phenomenon that people believe could explain this. Part of the boat and the nameplate are on display at the Maritime Museum of British Columbia. A year after the accident, the phantom ship was seen at night following the same path it had taken that fateful evening. In 1910, a ship that resembled the Valencia was seen by a group of mariners as it headed to the rocks near the location of its wreck 4 years earlier. This is said to be documented in the Seattle Times. I did try, but to no avail, to find this article. People apparently claim to this day to see the ghostly specter of the SS Valencia heading toward the reef in Patchena Point, fueling the rumors that the ghost ship Valencia is doomed to repeat her tragic end for all of eternity. This brings me to the end of the episode, so I really hope you guys have enjoyed exploring these coastal haunts with me. Hit that subscribe button and that like button to show me some love. As always, keep in touch with my social media accounts for updates. Both Instagram and Facebook can be found at Real Scary Podcast. If you've visited any of these places and have your own stories, please let me know via my email, realscarypodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out the blog post for episode 4. As always, you can find it on my website, realscarypodcast.ca, and click on the heading episodes. So in this blog post, there will be photos and extras about all of these places, and of course, the bonus location I promised you. So until next time, this is your friendly neighborhood host, Elise.